Dick and Company carve him up. Sloughing off his patronym, Cade, in order to announce his true genealogy, Jack demands silence, which Dick enforces. Thus begins a double oration. Cade's predatory mimesis of Mortimer, just as York had said with the plan in Act 3, Scene 1, and his comrades' metaplasmic refolding of him, punning on the alternative sense of Cade as barrel, on the mortar in Mortimer, deriding Cade as bricklayer, on Janet in Plantagenet to find his mother a midwife, restringing Lacey as laces, transposing the G and the D to put his father in the cage. Here's Jack. We, John Cade, so termed of our supposed father, or rather, of stealing a cade of herrings, says Dick, for our enemies shall fall before us, inspired with the spirit of putting down kings and princes, command silence! Silence! Says Dick. My father was a Mortimer. He was an honest man and a good bricklayer. My mother was a Plantagenet. I knew her well, she was a midwife. My wife descended from the Lacys. Indeed a peddler's daughter and sold many laces. But now of late, not able to travel with her furred pack, she washes bucks here at home. Therefore am I of an honourable house. Aye, by my faith, the field is honourable, and there he was born under a hedge, for his father had never a house but a cage. Valiant I am, as needs must, for beggary is valiant. I am able to endure much. No question of that, I have seen him whip 3 market days together. Dick the Butcher and John Weaver's refolding of Cade produces another we. As the tradesmen become rebels that Cade seeks to absorb, make his skin ripple or bubble, emitting a multiplicity of voices and words that are parenthetically and so insistently more present. As the play shows us, it's only such interventions as Jack's in the writing machine and Shakespeare's in the archival remains of popular protest. In other words, attempts that aim to mess with the efficacy of parchment and wax and the metaphorical ties that render some and not other uses of the world routine that will count or produce different types of worlds. That is, as long as there's no Lord Clifford to enter in Act 4, Scene 8 and disperse the crowd by magically saying the words, Henry V, Henry V. It's not parchment made of sheepskins, asks Hamlet. I'm my lord. Of calf skins, too, answers Horatio. They are sheep and calves which seek out assurance in that. I must speak to this fellow. Whose grave is this, sirrah? You dare not, as Hamlet tells Horatio, lay your trust in the writing machine. There's no trust or assurance to be found there. Its relays animate the dead. It betrays your trust, rerouting your desires. Henry V. There's no stock or security to be found in parchment. Like some kernel of idiotic, ecstatic joy, the mere name Henry V trumps all, disperses the crowd. And so, abandoned and on the run, we meet an uncertain bovine or ovine Jack Cade in Act 4, Scene 10, ready to famish, who has climbed over a brick wall into the garden to see if he can eat grass or pick a salad, where he is dispatched in short order by the otium-seeking Alexander Iden, who just happens to be out. Iden prides himself on his self-imposed rustication from the turmoils of the court to his small inheritance his father has left him. I seek not to wax great by others' waning, he remarks, or to gather wealth. Sufficeth, he adds, that what I have maintains my state, and I send the poor well pleased from my gate. Speaking from the same script of Platonic withdrawal that we find articulated by Raphael in Book 1 of Utopia, Iden enters the play with a full tummy, perfectly at ease with his self-regulating body and the well-maintained boundaries of his estate. Like some overly mimetic reader of Moore's Utopia, Iden presents as a recreational humanist, as he who regulates his body and his estate so perfectly as to achieve a state of equilibrium in his exchanges with the world. Input equals output. He needs nothing. He produces no surplus. Eden, in Hollandshed, termed Iden, or self-same, in the play, comes upon Jack, who snarls at him wolfishly. They draw, and Iden kills him. Jack dies with famine on his lips. Oh, I am slain. Famine and no other hath slain me. And I that never feared any am vanquished by famine. Jack's exit, dispatched by a recreating Iden, represents an uncertain signal. In what remains still perhaps the most influential reading of the scene, Stephen Greenblatt discerns the naturalization of private property rights as the marker of collective belonging, subtly folded into what will retrospectively be recorded as a defense of the realm from a monstrous traitor. Symbolic estate gives away to real estate, is how he puts it. Greenblatt is aware of the reference to court and country, but rules it part of the scenery, otherwise not operative. But there's more to it than that. Before he kills him, Ivan subjects Jack to a negative blazon, at every point magnifying their difference. The difference, that is, between the leisured and well-fed and the poor and the hungry. Between a recreating gentleman and a famished caid on his way to becoming cattle, to use the period's word for the range of herbivores it herds. Oppose thy steadfast gazing eyes to mine, demands Ivan. See if thou canst outface me with thy looks, set limb to limb, and thou art the lesser. Thy hand is but a finger to my fist, the leg a stick compared with this truncheon. The confrontation between a well-fed and well-read country gentleman and a famished illiterate or differently literate cave stands as a stark reminder of the causes of popular protest of the period, even as it may ostensibly stage the victory of private property as such. It's Cade who speaks the language of butchery in this scene, asking his sword to cut Ivan's chunks of beef, but the spectre of cannibalism it raises seems inclined to magnify the words we hear most often. Famine, and no other but slain me, or Cade's last words, for I that never feared any, and vanquished by famine. The Cade sequence ends then, as uprisings tended to, with the populace once again becoming the figural sheep of historical record, that is, by returning to the matter of subsistence that animated their demands in the first place. In 410, in effect, you will have been watching the retraining of Jack's mouth. No longer the self-predicating parliament of the land, the mouth of this wolfish sheep is denied flesh as he is forced to eat grass. Jack's final skin-turning performance, his becoming cattle, registers the efficacy of those institutionally sanctioned relays in the writing machine, but a proof against his and his fellows' acts of writing. Only in such things as Henry V is there true power. Then again, seeded into the play remains the crumpled figure of an innocent lamb, which serves as an antagonistic record or archival trace of actual rebel writing practices, and not simply rebel violence. This phrase endures, a latent, figural possibility, waiting to be unfolded by other audiences or readers, who might make of it the kind of fleshly difference the historical Jack and his fellows attempted, and which Haraway seeks to engineer today. Was this postural? Your answer may be no, it's the absence of Georgic. But the problem with Georgic, the best poem by any poet, but in the 16th century at least it's not clear if Dryden had said that, whether that would be taken to mean Virgil or Thomas Tusser, is that it's hard to know for sure whether it's for real or whether it's not a Renaissance form of reality TV. What I've attempted to do this afternoon is to inhabit pastoral as something in need of ongoing concern, a contact zone with the figurative and semiotic fine edge of the privileged multi-species of Western Europe, human, sheep, goat, dog, whose successive transformations by technologies old and new might render those metaphors and modes of citizenship or creaturely life with which they are allied negotiable. For me, this is the kind of archival politics or parasitic resignification of routines named past but still lived that embarking on a cultural prehistory of environmentalism entails. Though I hope, as you've noticed, I have not once used the words environment or nature as a valid referent. They are both terms that, to put it as bluntly as possible, we're going to have to live without if we are to discover a process of becoming in which we all, however cuddly or slimy, constitute a common world. Thank you. I hope that you have found this paper interesting.